Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 18th of February. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about General Motors and Chrysler, who presented plans to the Treasury Department yesterday to prove that they can be viable and that the billions of dollars they've already received in taxpayer loans have not been a waste. They asked for a lot more money, and we'll be talking about the amount of money they asked for. GM predicted before yesterday it could run out of money next month and said that it would like to receive additional money to keep the company viable. Let's look at the numbers here. GM already receiving $13.5 billion and asking over time for $16.5 billion more. Chrysler, $7 billion they've asked for, considered the weakest of the three auto companies, and asking for $2 billion more. We'll talk about Ford this hour as soon as we can find our guest to find out why they seem to be in better shape than these other auto companies. And we'll look at what workers are willing to give up here. Chrysler, according to news reports, may have a tougher time eventually convincing politicians that it is sustainable. They don't have a global manufacturing plan here, and their passenger car lineup is really not very successful. If the Obama administration decides that one of the automakers is not viable, they can call in the loans and the firm would be dismantled. But, of course, if you have dismantling of an auto company, you have many more jobs being lost and fewer people buying cars. And then how do you keep the car companies viable? And on it goes. We're trying to reach our guest right now, so bear with us for just a moment. He's a great guest. We just don't know where he is. He's not answering the phone. Gerald Myers, adjunct professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan, who happens to be former chair of the American Motors Company. He joined Ford Motor Company in 1950 and spent 8 years with the Chrysler Corporation, where he was director of manufacturing for all overseas plants in 1961. He lived in Geneva in 1962. He was director of purchasing for American Motors in Detroit, and in 77 became chairman and CEO. He engineered the merger of the company with the French automotive company Renault, and he's also president of Gerald Myers Associates, a consulting firm engaged in advising and assisting senior management. He's the author of When It Hits the Fan, Managing the Nine Crises of Business, and co-author of Dealers, Healers, Brutes, and Saviors, Eight Winning Styles for Solving Giant Business Crises. So there's his bio. We don't have to give it to you when we eventually find him and talk about the latest request on the part of the auto companies. And we are trying to get a hold of him right now. So let me grab my other papers here and tell you what's coming up next hour. We hope we'll find him momentarily. The next hour, we're going to talk about what's happening with veterans, particularly veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. Many more have turned up homeless than in previous wars, not that there aren't a number of previous wars homeless vets. But we're going to talk with a couple people, Phil Landis, who's the CEO of the Veterans Village of San Diego, which is, you know, there are 2,000 homeless vets in San Diego, of all places, and they are working very hard to get vets in counseling programs, for drug addiction programs, to find jobs for them, and have been extremely successful. We will talk about that with Phil, and also the founder and president of USA Together will be joining us. I don't know if you've heard some of these stories, but vets have posted some of their needs, and they're not, well, some of them are huge needs, but some of them are, can you help us get a washer and dryer? And they post a need, and then citizens respond to this. It's been extremely successful. It has helped many vets. So we'll ask a number of questions. Why are so many vets who do have benefits finding it difficult to find out what those benefits are? And why is there such a delay on some of these benefits so that they're not getting what they deserve for a long period of time? So that's coming up, hour number two of our show. And we are still looking for our guest for this hour. In the meantime, if you, I'll give you our phone number. And if you want to talk about what you have learned about the new requests for the auto companies, we would like very much to hear from you. If you are a member of a union, do you think that the UAW has needed to give up significant benefits? They're taking over the health care benefits now, as you know. Do they need to really scale back what they get? Not that they don't deserve what they get, but to keep the companies viable. Should the companies be kept viable? Should we just let them go if they don't perform very well? What do you think about the amount of money they're asking for? Other companies are not doing as well, but for the last couple of years, American car companies just haven't done as well as some foreign companies, particularly Japanese companies. We are going to ask you what you think about all of that. And, you know, maybe you've bought American for a long period of time, too. There's been some criticism of the quality of the cars. The big three are saying that they're working on that and already have started working on that. They're laying off a lot of people, which is of great concern if you're trying to stimulate the auto industry. What about the people who buy the cars? Some of them work in the auto industry. A lot of people work in the auto industry. So here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Katie Madsen is answering phone calls today. She'll get you on hold and we'll be with you on the air in a moment with the great hopes that Gerald Myers will be joining us this hour to give us his expertise on what's going on with the requests again for more money for the auto companies. 800-486-8655 is the number. You can also send an email if you'd like, and that's talk@wpr.org. We'll let them stack up and give them to our guest once he arrives. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. And let's start our calls with Scott from La Crosse. Thanks for helping me out, Scott.
Hey, hi. Doing what I can there, kiddo. I do have strong feelings about this, however, and I have been in unions for much of my working life, and even our unions would endorse Toyota products made in America. You know, I don't feel that I have any real loyalty to American auto companies because I don't think corporations are country loyal. I think these are multinationals. You know, they will shop jobs anywhere they want to go. But if a company will come here and employ American workers, in some cases union workers, that's the loyalty that I have.
Mm-hmm.
I think the trust between corporate America and the American worker is gone. And I think, you know, the young folks coming up these days really have it about right. You know, they're not signing on for companies for long runs. And I think the American industries really need to come to, I think they have to come to grips with two things. One is that, and the other is this, you know, why they do not back some kind of a health insurance program nationally, I've never understood. You know, even when Clinton was trying to do the health care reform, back then, these companies still had a cost that foreign corporations didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why they wouldn't get behind it then and let the insurance companies basically, you know, dictate that health care was not going to get reformed in the 90s, I really don't understand. And
what?
I guess I think those are the two issues they've got. Somehow they've got to rebuild trust with their workers, and I also think that they really do need to get behind some kind of health care reform.
Right. So what do you think about their requests for more money? Are they valid? Should we give it to them?
I just don't think they can make it. I mean, I certainly don't think Chrysler can make it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody says, well, General Motors products are, you know, yeah, we've improved our products and everything like that, and we've got this Volt that's going to come out. But when they talk about, you know, a car like the Volt, the assumption is what? That nobody else, none of the other companies are also working in that same vein? See, that's the problem, I think. If they come out with a Volt, they're not going to be the only ones that have a product like that.
Right.
You know, I'm sure you'll have Toyota or Honda or one of those out with a car that's similar. And then people go, well, you know, I've loved my Honda Civic or I've loved my Toyota Tacoma. Am I going to go with the Chevy Volt or will I go with the whatever they call the Honda, the Toyota?
Yeah.
I think it's a real...
I see your point. What do you drive, Scott?
Glad you asked. I have a Toyota Tacoma pickup truck that was built out in California, in Fremont, California, and I love it.
Great. All right. Thanks.
You know, it's 10 years old, and it runs like a top.
Good for you. 10 years old.
And it was
all right.
Made by American workers.
All right. Thank you, Scott, for getting us rolling.
Thank you, Kathy.
Okay.
Good luck with it
yeah,
all.
Yeah, thanks. Bye. Bruce from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there. In my opinion, these companies didn't market properly for years. And my example is, in 2008, I decided to buy another car. I'd had a Ford Taurus that I kept for, 13 years. It was a luxury car, had 150,000 miles
Goodness.
On it. And I said, well, Ford made a good luxury car. I'll look at Ford's. I was looking at all the smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. And, I came across the Ford Focus Wagon. And in 2008, I went online to try to find one at a dealer and to try to find them. And Ford had stopped making it. And they didn't even tell people in the United States they were not going to make the Ford Focus Wagon. So here they had a car they had developed in Europe that was very fuel efficient, very versatile, very useful. And they did stop making it in the United States the very year when people were clamoring for a small, fuel-efficient, flexible car.
Right.
I ended up buying a Toyota, even though I wanted to buy a Ford.
Hmm.
So, and everyone was online. I would go online, and there was this whole internet network of people going, what happened to the Ford Focus Wagon? Where is it? I can't buy one. What happened to it? And Ford didn't even announce that it wasn't going to make it until about 3 or 4 months into the year, they just said, we stopped making it. And it was like, what a stupid marketing decision. What were they thinking? And, I bought a Toyota.
Yeah.
So what can you say except they made very bad decisions for 25 years?
Should we give them more money? Is it too important for the American economy to not give them money?
I think that money should be spent in different ways. I think that money should be allocated to research for batteries, for plug-ins, and I think that money should be given to auto workers to retool and move to a new location. I don't think those companies should be bailed out as they currently exist. They have an entrenched corporate culture that is not flexible and is not changing and adapting to current consumer needs or interests.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think they're ever going to get off that boat. They're just rigid and fixed in their ways, and they're basically looking out for themselves at the upper management level. What's the easy way out for me? Whatever happens to the company, fine. It wasn't my fault. I didn't make those decisions. When you get a multi-layered corporation like this, where the decision making is fractured and tied up in special interests within the company, they can't ever adapt. It's like the British Army in the Revolution. They can't be flexible and adapt to the current situation. And I think they need to die.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your call.
Sure.
We did find another guest. We'll meet him in just a moment. Let's go to Christine from Beloit. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I have a Saturn SL2, a 1994 model. My Saturn was made when Spring Hill was still the guiding force for that particular brand.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed when GM folded the Saturn brand back into GM that instead of taking advantage of the fact that Saturn's model was working, what they did was they tried to turn it into GM, and it didn't work. It doesn't work for Saturn owners. And one of the things, when I heard last night that Saturn was one of the brands that they were thinking of dropping.
Right.
Well, I was thinking, why not Cadillac? Most people can't afford a Cadillac.
Some people can, though.
Why take a good brand that works well, that's affordable for most people,
mm-hmm.
and toss it out with the trash for a brand that's a dinosaur?
And when you bought it, it was wildly popular, wasn't it?
It was Saturn? Wildly popular. The changes that have been made to Saturns since GM has tried to absorb it into their culture have not been winning choices. They need to get rid of Wagoner, and they need to bring back the people from Spring Hill and let them guide their product lines, because those people knew what they were doing.
Thank you so much, Christine, for your call. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Rob's been able to secure another guest for us. We can't find the first guest. I don't know what happened to him. So hold on a second, and we'll be with him. Stay on the line, though, because your phone calls will still be pertinent for our conversation. We're going to be talking with a man who has great expertise in the auto industry labor issues area and labor relations particularly. And here is our phone number. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest now to talk about all of this is Professor Roland Zullo. He is at the University of Michigan. Academic discipline is in labor relations, and he is the assistant research scientist, Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Our lines are pretty filled. Dr. Zullo, do you pronounce it Zullo?
Zullo.
Fine, yeah. Dr. Zullo, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
Tell me about the concessions that auto workers have made in all of this. I know that they were working it out toward the last minute here. What have auto workers have to give up in order to keep these companies viable?
Well, they're trying to hold the line for their hourly workers, their hourly members. And also, the difficult balance for them is trying to protect the benefits they have for their retirees. My guess is that they'll go through and make certain cuts and allow for certain cuts. And, of course, the hugest concession was all of the plant closures and the loss of those jobs.
Right. And they made huge announcements yesterday of many more cuts, didn't they? Tens of thousands of jobs all over the world.
Right. Right.
That's
right.
Not good news.
No, it isn't. Now, you know, a company like GM and Ford, they do have some areas of growth around the world. China, Russia, for example, are two areas where they're growing. But they face very steep competition here in the States. And probably this is where we'll see most of the cuts.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that these companies, GM and Chrysler, I guess, specifically, can remain viable?
Well, I think to remain viable, they have to have a very diverse product line. And in Chrysler's case, they really have sort of invested in the past 20 years or so in developing more of the muscle car line, or reaching back to that 60s era when, you know, American cars were known for having a great deal of power. They also have, I think, some very attractive styling. So they put a great deal of emphasis on styling and power. And they were hit incredibly hard when gas prices went up and consumer preference shifted over to more fuel-efficient vehicles. I think GM has more in the works in terms of fuel-efficient cars. And I think, of course, Ford has a more diverse line, which makes them which places them in a little better position than the other two.
So Ford is the strongest. Did they have?
Yeah, only because of their product line. I mean, you know, financially, I think they're also in a precarious position. But because they have the Focus, for example,
right,
that you know, that is, they actually gained quite a bit of sales back when gas prices were very high. So they have a more diverse, I think, lineup.
I have a hard time understanding why all of those companies didn't, because we've been through this so many times before, why they didn't focus on cars that gave you great mileage. Where were their minds in this? Why didn't they think, well, you know, gas prices are up and down. They're probably going to be up again and then up again. Let's make sure that we give people what they're probably going to want.
Well, in part because what they're following is sort of short-term market demands.
Mm.
So it's true that in the 1980s, when gas prices went way up, they ran into the same kind of problem. And actually, it was that period, that 1980s period, that really opened the door for many smaller foreign manufacturers to come in and grab market share. And they, you know, we all sort of remember that era, and they certainly are aware of that era. But when gas prices went down, the American consumer is usually, you know, larger vehicles, but that's conditional on having inexpensive fuel. And when fuel prices went down, preferences clearly shifted towards larger vehicles. And this is where the big three were all making most of their money.
Mm-hmm.
They made very little money on their small vehicles. Their biggest, most profitable lineups were always also their larger vehicles. So in the short term, they were making money. It was, you know, 6 or 8 years ago, you know, they couldn't sell enough SUVs. And, you know, that all changed very rapidly.
Right.
So it's the issue is whether or not I think, you know, it's the extent to which these corporations develop a long-term perspective on what the consumer will need, as opposed to responding to sort of short-term surges in demands for certain kinds of products. Again, you know, looking at Ford, I think under the leadership of Bill Ford, because he has a background as, you know, as an environmental activist, they had developed a more fuel-efficient lineup early on, mm-hmm. even when gas prices were very low. And so, in a sense, that foresight places them in a slightly stronger position today.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Jim from La Crosse is next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay. Thank you for this program, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. It's not a question of liberal or conservative perspectives or pro-union or anti-union perspectives. I like to consider myself more progressive and certainly pro-union. The continued bailout of the auto industry and after years of bad decisions is creating disincentives to the economic process that they really must go through. They must go through a rebalancing of what they have been doing, and they will need to make very difficult changes and adaptations. Just giving them money to do so won't really cause the types of considerations and newer decisions and more challenging decisions that will need to be done. I think really that ultimately the plan will fail, and they'll prove to be not viable.
Hmm. Professor Zulu?
Well, I think, you know, we don't know. I mean, Jim might be right. The plan may fail. I would disagree, though, that they're not making some changes. I think that they are making some pretty dramatic changes in response as a condition for getting these loans. And let's keep in mind that they are loans. The intent is to have these companies pay back the loans. But, you know, so much of it depends upon whether the consumer market for autos shifts. And if it shifts in the direction of the big three, then they should be okay. It's interesting to me to sort of hear people talk about you know, the need for auto industry to change and all the conditions being placed on auto, when our banking industry seemed to have received far more money with far fewer conditions. And you know, I guess to those of us, you know, in the Detroit area, we see that as a bit of a double standard.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Peter next from southern Wisconsin. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Hello.
The reason I'm being vague about my location is I was up until last summer, I had a brief career selling Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep products. And so I have kind of a perspective on it that's a little bit unique. I think the blame goes all around with Chrysler in terms of, every end of the spectrum of the manufacturing process. You have what could be, for instance, the best minivans in the world, but from the management side, you can't sell a $35,000, $40,000 minivan that looks like the dashboard is an explosion in a Tupperware factory. At the same time, you can't sell a $30,000-$40,000 minivan that comes from the factory with the trim around the A-pillar hanging off and all these parts rattling around in the bottom of it. You can't... You make the some of the best pickup trucks in the world with the best warranty in the world, but there are only so many people in the world who have a use for that sort of thing. And it doesn't mean you keep on selling the same thing or trying to sell the same thing over and over and over again, regardless of changing economic situation. And then you go to the other end of the spectrum. Chrysler makes some really neat cars, both appearance-wise and performance-wise, but somebody needs a relatively inexpensive car that gets good gas mileage and doesn't look like it was styled by, at any rate.
Right.
My whole point is, it's with Chrysler at least, it's the full spectrum. You have a lot of really dumb management decisions and design and engineering decisions being made over and over again. And at the same time, I would say that at our dealership, one in five of the new vehicles that we got off the truck would have to go into our service area to have something fixed.
Oh, my gosh. Professor Zulu.
Yeah, I'd like to comment. I mean, I agree that developing a fuel-efficient, small, affordable, reliable car was something that I think Chrysler just didn't do very well. And they're paying for that now. But I would also like to add that part of the problem over the past couple of decades, really, is that all of the big three began really a policy of outsourcing for much of their parts. We saw the spinoff of Visteon from Ford and Delphi from General Motors as sort of an example of how that took place. But what had happened with the big three is that they took advantage of lower wage labor costs elsewhere, sometimes in the States, sometimes not in the States, to have their all of the most of their critical input parts shipped in, which had the negative effect of essentially transferring a lot of those design issues to other corporations, which I think was a critical mistake. It affects quality. It affects the way the whole vehicle is assembled and put together. It's responsible for most of the recalls that you had on some of their lines. Outsourced parts was really a mistake, I think, on their part. And perhaps that's in part what the speaker is somewhat referring to, right? The fact that vehicles came in and they needed to have work done on them. And most of the problems that arise from these vehicles can be traced usually to outsourced parts.
Thanks very much for the call. Were you impressed by what the companies have done already to restructure, to lay people off, to look at what brands they're going to continue and what will be discontinued, the money that they've already received? Are you happy with what they've given us, or do you think it needs quite a bit of work?
Well, I don't know if impressed is the word I would use. I mean, very concerned, of course, about the loss of jobs.
Sure.
And no one knows really whether this is going to work. I have to confess, I don't know enough about the finances of the big three to sort of say with any kind of confidence whether the money that they're asking for will be enough of a bridge to hold them over. Again, I have to go back and just emphasize that so much of it depends upon whether Americans, you know, buy their vehicles. They need to have that consumer demand for their product.
Mm-hmm. Christy is next from Madison. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
Hi.
My thought about it is this: I'm kind of upset about the whole thing. I think the big three, as a total, have always thought that they were some sort of a paragon. They were like above it all. They would never go under. And I know when you talk to people, they feel that way too. But now we've seen the truth. And I think through the years, we've seen them squish out competition. Another thing that really irritates me about the whole thing is, you know, Toyota and all of those other little foreign companies, and I got to say, I have always driven a Toyota since they've been available, came on the scene and took it over because of their great gas mileage, because of the competency of their cars. And another thing that bothered me is all of the technology that people are coming, you know, forward with has been out there for years to get us off gas, to get us, you know, to move us on. And I really feel taken advantage of and hurt, well, really slapped in the face by the big three that I know people supported all through their lives here, and yet they didn't care about the consumers enough to give us the best that was out there. And to me, that broke my heart. And in my personal opinion, let them fail. They're just another business. And as far as your person's comment about banks, banks have everything to do with money. Cars are expendable. Money is a way of life. So I don't think that the bank bailout should be compared at all. Because without banks, what would we do? Go back to mattresses? So that's how I feel, and I'll take my answers.
All right, thanks, Christy. Thanks for the call. Professor Zulu.
Oh, boy. Well, let them fail. It's important, I guess, in response, understand that the Toyotas, Hondas, and all the foreign manufacturers that are in the U.S. and competing against General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler had, I would say, two major advantages. The first major advantage is that they came here, built plants, and were able to hire a much younger workforce, and they don't have what are sometimes referred to as legacy costs. They don't have the retirees, which you know, over time the UAW has been able to negotiate benefits for retirees. You know, a very important benefit is they have health care coverage from when they leave the employment up until when they're able to get Social Security. And Medicare. So that cost is a burden on General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler that the newer transplants don't have. The second advantage I would say is as companies coming in and opening up shop in the U.S., often they receive huge subsidies from the states and the towns in which they located. And, you know, that form of a subsidy can also be, I think, considered as a way to promote their businesses, and of course, was to bring in jobs. But, you know, we have to think about that as not that different from the loans that the big three are asking for now. I mean, those were, you know, millions of dollars of tax rebates had been given to Toyotas and Hondas and all of the transplants when they came and they located. Again, that's a form of a subsidy. So, you know, to say that somehow the big three are undeserving of some help, but foreign transplants did it all on their own is just, it just doesn't square with reality.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. Let us go to Katie in email. I think the White House needs to think of an exit strategy for the auto bailout. We've already set a precedent for giving them money, but I see them coming back for more and more money. Robin from Shorewood. You think they will come back again and again? I don't know how that'll work.
Well, again, you know, trying to predict what will happen in the future is very difficult. You know, again, so much depends upon whether people begin buying their cars. And the American consumer is under all kinds of pressure because of the job loss and the economic conditions more generally. So, there's reasons to be pessimistic. So I can leave it with that.
But
it's very difficult. It's, you know, anyone who tells you that they can sort of forecast a year from now is either clairvoyant or crazy or a little bit of both.
More phone calls in just a moment. Stay where you are on the line. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Roland Zullo is with us. He is at the University of Michigan, and he is assistant research scientist in the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations. We're talking about General Motors and Chrysler presenting plans yesterday to the Treasury Department to prove they can be viable. They're asking for more money, and we're talking about all of that. Are you willing to give them more money? What do you think is wrong with these companies, why they are not successful? What about all the workers who, as part of viability plans, may lose their jobs all over the world? It's a big issue. So we'll take more calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about vets, particularly from Iraq and Afghanistan, who are in great need. We'll talk with an organization in San Diego working with some of the 2,000 homeless vets. And we'll also speak with someone who started this very interesting online service that allows vets to post the needs they have and have people who can help them meet those needs link up with the people who are in need. So that's coming up the second hour. Let's go to Steve from Houston. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Yeah, great show. I think, you know, a couple of comments. You know, the market for cars, for even Toyota and Honda, all of them are down 30, 40, 50%. I think from what I'm reading, that the market for new cars is not going to rise anytime in the next couple of years. It's been so oversaturated with so many rebates and employee discounts. Everywhere I go, I see new cars. It just, my understanding is there's not going to be a market. So, you know, the economic model that GM and Ford and Chrysler put forth is really outdated. I mean, you have job banks where people, my understanding is they can sit around for a whole year and not do anything to contribute to the company and basically collect a company welfare check and sit and play Quidditch. Or you have, you know, at $70 an hour, you have people retiring and getting full benefits. I mean, $70 an hour for the rest of their life. You have CEOs making $30 million a year. I think they ought to be allowed to go into Chapter 11 and come out and go and do an internship at Toyota. My understanding of Toyota plan is in Toyota, many CEOs in Japan, my wife is from Japan, if a company has this type of a problem financially, the CEOs typically will not take a penny from the company out of a sense of honor and shame, something that we have lost in America, and just want to help the company rebound. So I think we're going to have to tell the employees, you know, if GM's going to become a welfare state under the, you know, the coverage of American government, then American people, American taxpayers ought to have the right to dictate the terms. And I'm afraid that the unions have got their, you know, have got a lasso around Mr. Obama, and they're going to dictate the terms. But that shouldn't be right. I'm a small business owner, and I really don't want to pay for those type of benefits when they're not sustainable. I think the reality is the big three are going to go under, I believe. And I'm sorry to say I have friends that worked in Janesville up till December, and now they're unemployed. But that's the reality of the way business is. And it's a shame that we think we can rescue every company that's going under, because all we're doing is burdening our children with a debt.
All right, need to hold you there, Steve. Professor Zullo.
Yeah, Steve, I think first it's important to sort of sweep away this myth that somehow auto workers make $70 an hour. That's just not the case. They earn anywhere from $25 to $28 an hour for a line worker, and then they have benefits on top of that, which don't reach $70. That number was thrown out there and created by folks who wanted to just were trying to embarrass the UAW for what they've achieved. Now, what I often find interesting about sort of comments like this is, you know, what the auto workers were able to do, what the UAW was able to do, again, through negotiations with the big three, is establish relatively decent middle-class wages and benefits for these line workers. And I often puzzled, I guess, at people who are business owners who believe in a capitalist system, but somehow find fault with the development of jobs that are decent middle-class jobs. I mean, to me, when that sort of thing happens, that is the success of the capitalist system. That's telling you that the system that we have is working when you know, hard-working individuals can go to work each day and come home and make, earn enough to pay the bills. That's a good thing. To see that destroyed is rather sad to me. So I'm a little puzzled at sometimes the comments that you hear and the general attacks at the success that the UAW has had at securing decent wages and benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I also want to say, too, about the jobs bank. The jobs bank is another area that is not well understood by much of the public. The jobs bank was a program that was a trade between new technology coming in that was going to reduce the amount of labor and the union, which was trying to protect jobs. And the basic deal was that new technology, robotics and so forth, could come in and that people who were displaced would be put in a jobs bank and to give them the opportunity to take on another job somewhere else in the system. And they had certain rules for how people could, you know, would have rights into new jobs somewhere in the system. And that whole model made a lot of sense because there's a great deal of training that goes into all these jobs. And the big three wanted, they didn't want to lose the folks who were going to be displaced from their work. They wanted to keep them in their employ so that they could take on a job somewhere else in the system. The reason why it failed and the reason why people ended up in the jobs bank for extended periods of time, to a great extent, was because of the loss of market share. No one anticipated that steady erosion of market share.
Yeah.
So it was. There's some history to that plan that's important to understand.
Do you have to go immediately, or can I ask you one more question?
No, you can ask another.
Oh, good. I want to ask more about this healthcare question. We had an email, Justin, from Stevens Point. If we had universal healthcare, would that help the big three? And what about the union being scheduled to take over responsibility for the retiree healthcare obligations? How does that factor into making these companies viable? And what about universal healthcare? Would that change the whole picture here?
It would be a huge, huge help, not just for the big three who are shouldering that burden for all of their retirees. Keep in mind they have something like four times or three times as many retirees as they have active members, and they're covering the health care for those folks. So it would be a huge, huge benefit to them, and it would be a huge benefit for American manufacturing more generally.
Mm-hmm.
Every other industrialized nation has this, and there's a reason they have this. When we were tracking job loss in Michigan, the closure of parts plants, it was interesting to document the movement of jobs because while many of the jobs were shut down in the Michigan upper Midwest area, went to places that are low wage, like Mexico, we also noticed that a significant proportion were actually going to Canada. Now, in Canada, you know, Canada is not a country with low wages, and they actually have more unions than we have here, proportionately. So these companies were not escaping unions, and they weren't escaping high wage. What they were doing was going to an area where they had a sensible health care system that would cover their employees. So the health care, if we could resolve the health care issue, achieve universal coverage, that would be a huge, huge benefit.
And will the unions be able to deal with this retiree health care obligation?
It's a huge issue that is being debated, I'm sure, as we talk. I think that the critical issue for the VEBA is how it's financed. There is an obligation of the companies to fund the VEBA. Will it be financed with some diversified set of investments, or will it be financed primarily with GM and Ford stock? I mean, that's the issue. So the question is sort of what are the investments backing up the VEBA?
Right.
It's going to be a huge area of negotiation right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you ever so much for being with us. I deeply appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks. Dr. Roland Zullo, our guest, and we thank him for changing his schedule to be with us. He is at the University of Michigan, Assistant Research Scientist, Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations. We're going to just continue on this and take phone calls. He had to go teach a class, so our lines are pretty filled here, and we'll just welcome your calls for the remaining few minutes. Judy is next from Richland Center. Hi, Judy.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say that I drive a Toyota. And the reason I had, before I bought the Toyota in 05, I had always drove American, but I did a lot of research because the car is a major, major thing to buy. And everything about the Toyota was better than the American-made cars. But I don't think it's a matter of should we let them fail or not. I think it's a matter of they're going to fail because people keep losing jobs and people are not buying cars. If people aren't buying cars, it isn't going to matter what they make. I think it's the country is in terrible trouble, and I just think it's inevitable. And to continue throwing money at this until the government finally admits it, I just think it's making more debt for our children, and I think that sooner or later it's going to happen. Mm. Thank you.
So you're just saying let it happen sooner. Let them fail now?
Well, I think instead of incurring more debt for our children, yes.
All right, Judy. Thank you very much for your call. Uh-huh. Tim is next from Madison, and we have a couple lines open, 800-486-8655. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't think it's any coincidence that GM and Chrysler are in the worst shape of the big three, because the one person associated with that and with the lineup that they've basically had over the past 10 years has been Robert Lutz, who's currently vice chairman of GM. And was, I think, retiring at the end of the year, early next year. And if you look up on Google, you know, what he's been associated with and what he's earned, he's going to parachute out of there with about something like half a billion, with a B, dollars. Mm-hmm. Not at one time, of course. That's his, I think, career earnings between those two companies. So basically they've paid this guy who's, you know, really kind of an American car hero associated with more with muscle cars and big sheet metal and, you know, things that don't have good gas mileage. I think he set the path for these companies. And, you know, of course, we're in bad economic times now and nothing's selling well, including Toyotas and the hybrids and things like that. But, I mean, I basically think he put them in a completely non-viable position because, of course, when the economy does recover, these companies are not going to have, you know, the lineup that compares favorably with the car companies that have made small, fuel-efficient cars.
Do you think they'll still be around when the economy recovers?
They're not going to be around in the way that they are now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're going to be, you know, they're going to be tiny, and only if they develop. I mean, they're basically being disrupted. You know, you think about this in technology terms. I mean, we use terms like disruption all the time when talking about how the internet is disrupting newspapers and whatever. But only if they disrupt themselves and have a something like a Saturn, you know, kind of a what they call like a skunk works, where they build this, you know, whole division that's devoted to basically coming out with a new line of fuel-efficient cars that are well-designed and that are perceived as high quality.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're just not going to be sheet metal pushers. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Hummer's going to be gone. Obviously, Suburbans, you know, they're going to shift that stuff out of Janesville into other plants, and the number of Suburbans they're going to be selling will be 30% of what it was. And, I mean, all this stuff is contingent on gas mileage, but, of course, I think the more federal regulations go in place, too, the more difficult these cars will be to sell as well, even probably irrespective of of oil prices.
Right.
Another point I wanted to make,
okay.
this is my originally why I called,
sure.
Is that, you know, GM doesn't sell cars to people. They sell cars to dealers.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually recognize their revenue. You know, whenever you see the truck that has all the cars on it going to the dealer, that's when GM gets paid.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole way that they've structured the dealer networks and you know, the state laws regarding dealer protection. I mean, I don't know the exact number of GM dealers in Wisconsin, but let's say it's at least 500 and maybe as many as 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a state like Wisconsin does not need 1,000 dealers or 750
right.
dealers of GM.
Right, I understand.
It certainly doesn't have that many of Toyota, and that stuff all has to be just completely redrawn, too.
Thank you, Tim, very much for your call.
Thanks.
Well, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. It was it was an hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for getting on the phone and getting us another guest and for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Madsen for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls and email. A great deal of interest in this topic. I do want to tell you that tomorrow at this time period, we should have a great hour tomorrow, the author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power, the chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, David Sanger, has written a book on this, and he will be with us tomorrow during this time period. So I hope you'll join us. That's it for this first hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and then an hour you won't want to miss. Maybe you can be of help in helping veterans, but the stories about veterans are rather appalling, those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll talk about all of that. So stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.